Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane promises to press on with an investigation into the exchange of lewd and objectionable emails on state computers. This after the state Senate this afternoon failed to muster the requisite votes to kick her out of office. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me to make sense of the latest is John Micek, editorial and opinions editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. John, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Dave, thanks for having me.
Now, let's add this to the mix as well. The State House was busy today on the matter, granting a committee power to begin the process that could result in her impeachment. Did state senators ultimately pass the heavy lift onto the House today?
I think that's true. I mean, it was going to have to be a two-thirds vote in the Senate to remove Attorney General Kane from office. And it became pretty clear early on that there weren't going to be the Democratic votes to do that. It might have been the more expeditious one from a procedural point of view, but from a policy and political point of view, marshaling two-thirds support in the Senate was always going to be an impossible lift. The process that's unfolding or is set to unfold in the House now is one that even Kane herself had said was the more appropriate course for them to take. It's also the one that Democrats believe is the more appropriate course for lawmakers to take on this.
Though ultimately, if the House does impeach, that would then go on to the Senate.
Correct. I mean, it's the same two-pronged processes at the federal level. There would be a hearing in the House and a trial that would then take place in the Senate with a vote to impeach.
Now, let's review. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court temporarily suspended her law license in October for an indefinite period of time. On what basis did they take that action?
Well, that was the small matter of her of the pending criminal case against her. As your listeners probably know, Attorney General Kane has been charged with perjury and other offenses in connection with allegedly improperly leaking grand jury and other investigatory material to embarrass political critics. They suspended her license as a consequence of that, and this effort grew out of the law license suspension, which was actually upheld by the Supreme Court last week.
Democratic Attorney General and today's Senate vote was predictably essentially along party lines, although even some Democrats said they were fine with, for example, Kane voluntarily stepping down. They just didn't want to vote that way. Were they afraid it would set a precedent?
Well, I mean, it is a heck of a precedent. I mean, they are undoing the results of an election by voting to remove her. And that's, that is what Kane herself had argued. But at least one Republican pointed out that, the law provides for that. Election is not a blank check to do whatever you like or immunity from eventual prosecution. That's why impeachment mechanisms exist. And that's why this obscure clause of the state constitution similarly exists.
I believe it was Senate President Pro Tem Joseph Scarnati who noted that you could lose your driver's license, you could lose your haircut or license and lose privileges of practicing. So that why should the attorney general be permitted to stay on with a suspended law license?
Yeah, that is in fact what the gentleman from Jefferson County said. And, it's not an uncompelling argument either.
Meanwhile, Kane is trying to get on the April 26th primary ballot for a second term. How's that working out?
It's moving forward. I guess we'll know if she got the petition signature she needed next week when nominating petitions are filed. It's getting to be a fairly crowded room out there. Steve Zappala, the district attorney from Allegheny County, and Josh Shapiro, the chairman of the Montgomery County Commissioners, have stepped up to challenge her in the spring primary.
Little sense that she'll take that aforementioned suggestion and voluntarily step down?
Considering that Penn Live has called on her three times to resign and many more people who are far more important than us have called on her to resign and she's resisted it, it doesn't seem like a likely scenario.
We're speaking with the ever-important John Micek. John, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
John Micek is editorial and opinions editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. Following 2 days of investigation, Delaware County officials say the police shooting of a man in the city of Chester was likely justified. Following a short car chase, officers fired nearly 100 rounds at Shalimar Longer. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports.
Around 2 a.m. Monday morning, Delaware County District Attorney Jack Whalen says police from Upland Borough called in a minor traffic violation.
The Upland police officer noticed that the license plate light was burnt out. And in the process of calling in the license plate, the vehicle took off.
Police from three different departments followed the car, driven by 33-year-old Shalimar Longer, onto a narrow residential street in Chester. He has a record and was on both parole and probation. Longer's cousin, Asmar, was in the car with him. According to authorities, he later said that Shalimar was afraid of going back to prison and pointed a gun at police. At that point, six officers fired dozens of rounds, says Whalen.
We would say at this point over 50, could be as close to 100.
A neighbor near the scene says she counted 92 evidence markers showing where shell casings fell after the shooting, but Longer never discharged his weapon. Whalen says when police decide to use deadly force, they'll often shoot until their clips are empty.
When we do our analysis, we're looking at not whether or not they shot once, twice, or 10 times. What we're looking at is, did this individual have the right to fire that weapon from the beginning?
He says the investigation will continue, but preliminary evidence suggests deadly force was justified. The DA's office said there are no dash cam videos of the incident from police cruisers. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Delaware Governor Jack Markell today signed a resolution apologizing for the state's role in slavery. Details from WHYY Zoe Reed.
The Delaware State University Concert Choir sang Lift Every Voice and Sing inside the public archives in Dover to celebrate signing the resolution. The occasion also included a proclamation recognizing African American History Month and kicked off the 125th anniversary of the historically black university. Markell said the apology reminds Delawareans of the nation's past, but also the work yet to be accomplished.
It's a powerful signal that we recognize what happened in the past. But what's more important, frankly, than the apology is the commitment that we all make now to work together toward the future. And I think that was really how I tried to position this. It's an important step, but what's really more important is the work we do so that every Delawarean can achieve their potential.
Representative Stephanie Bolden is the main sponsor of the bipartisan resolution, which was first introduced by Senator Margaret Rose Henry in 2010.
It's important to start the healing process. It's just a beginning because there's so many things going on, but it's a beginning. And people feel comfortable within the beginning and the acknowledgement.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania and Delaware reported their first cases of Zika this week. As WHYY's Alana Gordon reports, officials stress the cases pose no threat to the public, but they are reminding those traveling to Zika-affected regions to take preventive measures.
The two cases in Pennsylvania and one in Delaware involve travel to a part of the Caribbean or Americas where the virus is widespread. The three females experienced mild symptoms. Dr. Carol Rittay, who oversees public health for Delaware, said in a conference call the state's confirmed Zika case comes as no surprise.
This is not unexpected, given the number of reported cases nationally and internationally. I want to emphasize that there is no threat of local infection from this case.
Philadelphia's health department says it's not aware of any cases among area residents. Nationwide, about three dozen Zika cases have been confirmed, including one in New Jersey. All have been travel-related. The virus is mainly transmitted through mosquitoes, and the one that's been linked to the outbreaks is not present in this region. Officials stress the best way to avoid Zika and other viruses while traveling to affected areas is to prevent mosquito bites. That includes using repellent containing DEET and sleeping under nets. Zika symptoms are generally mild, but scientists are concerned about a possible link to serious birth defects among newborns of infected moms in Brazil. For that reason, officials here are advising pregnant women who've traveled to affected areas to be tested, even those who don't have symptoms. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, the Christie campaign reports that the New Jersey governor has suspended his bid for the Republican presidential nomination following yesterday's poor performance in the New Hampshire primaries. Assembly Speaker Vinnie Prieto believes having Christie back in New Jersey full-time will make it easier to resolve the state's major issues.
We live in the 21st century. You know, obviously, we have a lot of mobile devices, and we can get, you know, talked to, but there's still, for me, there's nothing like sitting across the table and seeing the whites of the eyes of the person that you're talking to get things accomplished. That personal touch, I think, is always better.
In other news, Philadelphia's Love Park is gearing up for some sprucing up. The city broke ground today on a year-long renovation of the tourist attraction. Catherine Ott Lovell is the city's Parks and Recreation Commissioner. She says the iconic Love statue will be moved across the street to City Hall's Dilworth Park in the next few weeks. It's not clear how long it will stay there. The current park is a skateboarding haven, and Mayor Jim Kenney urged skaters to use it until it closes February 15th, telling them that they are the part of the park's fabric. 33 degrees, cloudy skies at 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, cloudy, falling back to 24 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, rebounding to 27. Winds picking up will make it feel much colder. Friday, plenty of sunshine, high 28 degrees. The weekend, a chance of scattered snow showers on Saturday, otherwise partly sunny, blustery, and cold, high 19 degrees, down to 2 overnight on Saturday. Sunday, sunny skies, high 16. Still ahead, a choreographer attempts to interpret the music of Amy Winehouse into dance without being influenced by her personal struggles.
If anybody's looking for an answer, if they want to figure out the secret code of the work by looking at her life, that's not in there.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Oil prices are plummeting, and yet Saudi Arabia keeps on flooding the market.
Saudi Arabia has huge reserves, financial aid. They can get away for several years with running huge budget deficits. It's not that they're in an immediate crisis.
I'm Kai Rizdal, sustaining the Saudis, next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists offers the Watchman device, an innovative, minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Next time you post to Facebook, take a moment to consider who owns the content on your page. It's a question with legal implications for individuals and commercial consequences for businesses with social media accounts. Let's explore the topic with WHYY social media strategist Amy Quinn. Amy, let's focus on a recent Legal Intelligencer article. It cited businesses that cultivate Facebook likes to broaden their marketing reach and effectiveness. Legal, not legal, it's a very gray area.
It's a gray area and it's a fascinating area. This particular case involved a woman who started an unofficial fan page for her favorite television show. Later, she entered into a business relationship with the network that aired this TV show, BET, and eventually gave them access to the back end of the page. So they could log in, they could post, they skyrocketed the number of likes her page had. Eventually, their business relationship went sour and BET locked her out of her own account. The judge ruled that the Facebook likes are not part of the physical assets of the company, that they simply indicate a momentary desire on the part of another Facebook user who could very instantly unlike your page just as easily.
Now, of course, social media sites provide terms and conditions governing the creation and usage of their accounts. Facebook's terms, for instance, provide that an individual creating a user profile does own the content that he or she posts, but that may or may not be at variance with established law on the matter.
There are differences between whether it's a personal page for your personal use or a business asset page that you're creating. Facebook's terms of service are very specific in saying you own your content unless you give us specific permission to use it, which is very easy to do without realizing you're doing it. Hey, Dave. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Wah.
Wahoo.
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 I'm not just doing this for the laughs. There's another angle of the idea of who owns social media content that is less about the actual content itself and more about the idea and the style of the content. So, for instance, I told you a knock, knock joke, but I told you a specific joke, right? Who came up with the idea of a knock-knock joke and who owns a copyright on that style of joke? This was another legal case that involved the Fine Brothers, who were a very popular team of comedians on the internet. They do videos that are sort of grandmoms react to videos of them dancing when they were kids. And so they have made their stock in trade this sort of shtick, you know, so show someone something shocking, watch them react to it, record it. They tried to copyright the idea of a reaction video. So if I wanted to show my grandmother Beyonce's new video and then videotape her reacting to it, they would have wanted their users to license that idea from them. So the court did not make a ruling on that because the Fine Brothers lost 300,000 subscribers to their YouTube channel and withdrew their petitions for trademark. So they changed their mind after creating bad karma on the internet with their subscribers.
So in this case, it was the market that spoke rather than the court.
Correct. And what it told them was something very powerful about the idea of viral content on the internet. You can now search an image on the internet back to its original source and find out who was the first person to transpose Michael Jordan's crying face over top of an athlete that just lost something, which is a major meme on the internet right now. Who was the first person who did that? Do I owe them money now if I decided to make one on my own? If I use a meme generator app and I put my own words on it, who owns that? Did I create something new or not?
But ultimately, this will be decided more succinctly in the court of law. And in the meantime, are there caveats for consumers?
The caveats with the consumer are if you are doing something independently and then you're going to turn it into a business, be aware that the law changes then. Once you start trying to monetize your internet experience, be very careful.
I have an elephant joke for you, but I have to make sure it's legal before I test it out.
Okay.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
WHYY social media strategist Amy Quinn on NewsWorks Tonight. This week, the Philadelphia modern dance company Ballet X is premiering a new work based on the music of Amy Winehouse. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports.
Since Amy Winehouse's death in 2011 from a drug overdose, her music and her tragedy have become entwined in the popular imagination. To create a dance based just on her songs, choreographer Trey McIntyre had to separate Winehouse's life from her art.
Like, I wasn't going to use the song Rehab originally. It plays out as a story and absolutely related to her life, we know that. But I found my way in, and I found a way to really pull us out of that, I hope. If anybody's looking for an answer, if they want to figure out the secret code of the work by looking at her life, that's not in there.
McIntyre used to be based in Boise, Idaho, where he directed his own dance company. Since dissolving that company 2 years ago, he has become something of a nomadic artist. The Philadelphia modern dance company Ballet X invited him to invent his Amy Winehouse project with its own dancers. Well, sometimes I go out bars. McIntyre was most attracted to Winehouse by the sound of her voice. Although he never met her, he identified with her artistic struggle.
My identification with her, it centers around getting comfortable with being in one's own best part. We all have this conflict, like we all want to be unique and special, but I have come to find that it's those things that truly make us unique are the things that make us very lonely. You know, an artist really has to do this. You have to lean into that part of yourself. You have to explore it and tear it open, and I think that is an inconsolable loneliness.
Ballet X will also feature work by the company's co-founder, Matthew Neenan, and a piece by a new choreographer named Yin Yu. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
As we age, the things we remember and those we forget can be both a curse and a blessing. Our commentator, Diana Allen, learned that for some elderly patients with memory impairment, remembrances aren't always gone, but rather just require a bit of encouragement.
There was a time when, like many people, I didn't expect to find myself at a retirement facility until my future children put me there. A few months ago, when I was approached to perform vocal concerts for homes around Montgomery County, I agreed apprehensively. I associated elder care with memories of my grandparents in Alzheimer's units, memories that felt far too fresh. I'll be with you in apple blossom time. Still, I put together a 20-song repertoire. Rodgers and Hammerstein, Frank Sinatra, the Andrew Sisters. Choosing songs I hoped would spark a connection in the residents' minds. Like how my pup-up's expression would remain empty, but his fingers would tap in perfect unison to the Beatles. I think that might be too melancholy, my mother had told me, as I packed sheet music for Somewhere Over the Rainbow. With my emotions carefully tucked away, I prepared myself to tackle my first concert as the business venture I wished to see it as. Instead, the room full of strangers effortlessly broke down my barriers when their choir of voices joined me in song. Since then, I've never sung Judy Garland on my own.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
I stay for a while after each concert to hear the residents' stories. Although they sometimes lack clarity, the stories are still brimming with life. The residents talk about their favorite operas, offer me comical stage name suggestions, and reminisce about a song that reminds them of a loved one who is now very far away. I met a man who had his own history in radio, as a voice on a local children's program when he was little. One day, a resident who studied at a music conservatory in Salzburg, Austria in her youth, reciprocated with the gift of a piano recital. Another, a small Italian woman, who reminded me of my late grandmother, spontaneously joined me at my microphone and sang each word of Caro Mio Ben from memory. Every time I go to a new facility, music opens a door for the residents to gain awareness of the present, even if the song stirs a musical memory of the past. Residents who act aggressively or who struggle with dementia often find solace during musical performances. Each caretaker I have met over the past few months stressed how the universality of music permits these relationships to strengthen. Music therapists often serve in hospice care. They aim to address the social, emotional, and spiritual needs of their geriatric patients. Creating and listening to music offers their patients a portal into expression that often escapes them. In these homes, music is not just entertainment, it's a form of caregiving. I'm Diana Allen.
Diana Allen is a freelance writer and vocalist from Montgomery County. You can read more essays from area residents at newsworks.org/speakeasy. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas with help today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
The dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are